Blog Talk Radio.
To us about what's eventually to come, about some of the pitfalls that men have experienced through time, and not whining and complaining about the changes, the forces that influence us day by day that are beyond our control. If economics was about cause and effect, if it was that simple, well, we'd all be down to the racetrack picking the winning horse all the time. Life's a delightfully more complex, because nothing less would be tedious for a mind like yours, human mind, while we have personalities stamped on it, and character is so plastic, so malleable, so imaginative. Today we have a good program for you. The commentary, I think, is one of those things that'll make your, maybe it'll make your brain scratch, itch out just a little bit, just a little bit. And not preachy, though. That tends not to work so well. The music, oh, Liz is rather pleased with the music that we've selected here. This is in the poetry of Alfred Tennyson. Because of his poetry, he was made a lord. Can you imagine? If you become attentive to you become sensitive to to emotion, to ideas, then you've already gone on to pursue your own way of studying and learning more and experiencing more. Not everybody is inclined that way. The agora, as the Greeks would teach us, has characteristics that daze and amaze. The hundreds who were in the jury at the trials, the chaos, and how we today take for granted the symmetry and simplicity and coherence that has been brought about. Well, I hope you'll find a time. Sit back with us. It'll be worth your while. I can promise you that. Freemasonry is just the inspiration we needed. So fill up your favorite glass or cup with the right beverage. Sit down and collect your thoughts. Put on your headphones. Tune out the world. And let us entertain and inform. Here we begin with a little music that just will stir the soul. This is the fabulous pianist, Oliver Jones. Thank you. It's always pressing that we have some sense of control, don't we? Even if the scientists tell us, explain to us that, and the philosophers explain to us that it's an illusion. If we acknowledge the frankness of mathematics, the forces that are at play around the world don't change because it upsets us. The world and a universe and existence isn't Santa Claus. Oh, we can have those attitudes. We can make those choices if we choose. We can try and simplify a world, and we can convince ourselves that we've achieved that. But generally, the point that we're trying to achieve is some degree of satisfaction. You know, whether we deny something, some feature of our life, and then we can feel satisfied as long as we do that. Oh, gentlemen, and then we want to examine conscience and wonder what it is, and do it in a purposeful, organized way. Here along comes masonry. Its presence of mind and thinking is often astounding if we give ourselves the opportunity to examine it. It's a way of getting ahead of the problems, not to control the odds. No. The odds are what they are. Unexpected things happen, unfortunate and unpleasant things happen, and that test, unless we are consumed by the notion of denial, whether we're chasing it in some form of intoxication, we find that we're able to be inspired, and it's not so much the act, is it? Is it the reasons behind it, the justification? And some, now we know the difference in our capacities, allow some people to focus in ways that are just remarkable. That attention to detail and that capacity to remember. Of course, that requires that we use information repeatedly, or it requires a sleight of hand that happens in our brain. Some that are able to retrieve information from a great long time ago. That's what's beginning to add to what's going on in me as I reach the age I am. I'm able to retrieve. But with the choices that I have, I don't want to or need to. Masonry does that for us. Perspective to use as we choose. And for more younger men who are like you and I pursuing that question, is there more, or is this understanding, or how do I understand, or those essential philosophical questions that we don't like to admit. A moment to contemplate. Gain control over your anxieties. Recognize, as a better man does, that putting your feet on the ground allows us to not necessarily feel wonderful inside about having them, but acknowledging our conceits. I guess maybe it has something to do with that health, the ability to laugh at oneself. Too personal. Well, let's keep the masonry as impersonal as we can. We need to do that in Lodge. But there's also the undeniable fact that Freemasonry was all embracing. Smarter men, more articulate readers particularly, do well. Studious types, contemplative types. Oh, we need that. Whether we need it or not, we have that mixture of gregarious characters. Populism doesn't serve us really as well as our history teaches us. But take a deep breath here with me. Take a deep breath. Maybe this is the pause that we all need to recognize that we are also, around the face of the earth, a thread, a connection, a singularity. As different is, but nevertheless, a singularity. To be sure, Freemasonry has been a resilient gold standard. Infallible? Perhaps. Aspirational? Conclusively. Mentors come and go. The best are those who understand how to instill a sense of trust and authenticity in others. Carrot and stick expects us to do the next thing right. Ethics and values teach us to do the next right thing. There are growing lists of examples of military and competitive sports franchises achieving a greater success when they have brought values-based training and education that recognizes the humanness of an individual in stark contrast to powerful systems that treat people as commodities. We could call it volunteering, but isn't it likely we are witnessing opportunity? We could call it volunteering, but isn't it likely we are witnessing opportunity? Today, educators know that teaching happens when students are receptive. Entire philosophies have been built around ways to enhance those opportunities and optimize learning. The results have been stunning. Communicating and sharing this wonderful outcome faces barriers, even as common sense tells us the value. When we have been worked enough, studied enough, laughed at our shortcomings, or learned from our own mistakes and grown, those insights are known only to a single person. No fanfare, no recognition, no ego stroking. Growth happening without carrot and stick. It is odd in a way that each of us tends to believe the mountain we climb is steeper than yours. The order only shows the path, but the motivation is individual. Character isn't limited to what happens to a man. Character is a measure of how we react to what happens. So many choices. How is a man to know which to make? Fortunately for us, Freemasonry covers that abundantly. In ritual, I smile, in ritual, metaphor, allegory, steeped in values and ethics and morality, not standing around moralizing. No, not dress up, but a feeling, but applying our values becomes a moral imperative. Know what I mean? Yeah, you do. Aujourd'hui dans le cœur, dans la chanson.
to them.
Wonderful doing all the Edith Piaf covers. Not to like. Maybe it is the expression of the soul of our existence. Maybe. Maybe it's the revelation of that, the metaphysic that we're all capable of understanding once we know where it is and what it is. Serves a function, doesn't it? Yeah. This, so we're going to talk a little bit about the the writer here. This is, I don't know if it's a preoccupation. It's more than a, I'm curious that if I would keep walking past these ideas, just because they're not contemporary, that, and without questioning why they have endured for as long as they have, I think the fool is on me. Coming from my background, I've had to give up some things to gain some things, mocked constantly. Because I had a, because of not a competitiveness or conceit, but a curiosity, not trying to elevate myself above other people, curious. One of the more challenging lessons was allowing myself the opportunity to learn from sources that weren't, for me, traditional. In other words, at a younger age, I was beginning to attempt to go past my own experiences to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And son of a gun, you can. And then I find a whole field of thought about this. That's what's really quite embracing about the internet. It allows me to quickly and almost impulsively find information to validate or discount ideas, give me more information and context. Tonight, today, though, we're going to be listening to the work of Lord Tennyson. He wasn't born a lord. He became the first Baron Tennyson of Aldworth in Freshwater. But because of his writing in 1884. But this guy was born on August 6, 1809, in Somersby, in England. And he's regarded as the chief representative of the Victorian age in poetry. Now, to think that, to dismiss the impact of the Victorian age and English colonialism is hard to do on the face of the earth. Remember, they were dealing with, we're looking at a culture that was, had a history that we can examine. Just as we do with the Greek systems, with the Roman systems, and now here in the West, we have gradually and eventually, and thanks to Freemasonry, and geometry and astronomy, we've turned our eyes to the East to understand the culture, the Chinese culture, the gifts, the insight. I don't know anymore whether I refer to the Mohammedans or the Arabs or the Middle East, the richness of experience brought intellectually. The intellectual richness, these enormous think tanks, from the great Khan, who ruthless, yes, had a curiosity about your religion and your background. And as long as you weren't playing silly bugger, he would embrace you with this notion in exchange for his benevolence, in quotes. Was to listen to new ideas that came from other cultures. I know today it's hard to, I guess in any period, it's hard to justify so much pain for them. But Alfred Lord Tennyson teaches us about a period, about ourselves. He was the fourth of 12 children. His father was a rector, so a man of letters. Yeah? And he went to, we know the grammar school he went to when he was a boy, not a very happy boy, but he was precocious. And before his teens, he had composed in the styles of Alexander Pope and Sir Walter Scott and John Milton influences. He was borrowing, just like an intern apprentice. You pick up the ideas of the master first, and then you gradually develop your own style. And he is part of a collective of unpublished poems that were published after his death in 1930 called The Devil and the Lady, when he was a boy, which shows an astonishing understanding of Elizabethan dramatic verse. He was Lord Byron was a dominant influence. Oh, my goodness. I don't know. I'll edit that out, of course. So in the rectory in Somersby, the children were thrown upon their own resources. And all writers on Tennyson emphasize the influences of Lincolnshire countryside, the plain and the sea, the sand-built ridge, the waste of enormous marsh. Mm-hmm. And then his father's health started to go break down, and he took refuge and drank. And Alfred was depressed by unhappiness and at home, but he continued to write. By 1827, Alfred and his brother Charles joined Frederick at Trinity College and the other brother. There, Alfred made friends with Arthur Hallam, the gifted son of the historian Henry Hallam. And this is the deepest friendship of Tennyson's life. And the friends became members of the Apostles, an exclusive undergraduate club of earnest intellectual interests. But his reputation as a poet increased at Cambridge. Ideas appealed to people of ideas. But he reacted. He fell into a misery in 1831 when his father died. And it was increased by his grandfather's discovery of his father's debt. A real person, man. A real man. Now, the poem that I've selected for us today is The Lady of Shalott. The why poetry, you know? You already know. Oh, are you, has your drink evaporated? Sir, do you need to a moment to get up and top it up? All right. I'm going all 16th century here, thick coffee. Tennyson became a very famous and a popular poet over the course of his career. 40 years, imagine. And he was a big deal at a time when England was itself a big deal. The Lady of Shalott was an early work written before he was a star. He first published his poem in an 1833 book, and then again in a much more successful 1842 version. It was just the right moment for a work about King Arthur. Yes, that's the magic there, huh? In the Victorian era, the English were crazy about stories about Arthur. And this poem was embraced not just by readers, but also by painters, who used it as inspiration for a bunch of famous paintings. And in fact, people were still pretty nuts about this poem. It's got a blend of fantasy and tragedy that still fascinates readers and painters and musicians. And if you don't believe us, take a look at the web. We've picked some choice examples. If you've watched Lord of the Rings or read Harry Potter, you really owe it to yourself to get to know the Lady of Shalott. This poem is alive with the same sense of fantasy, adventure, and magic that you'll find in those works. Plus, this won't take you hours to get through. It's a compact and intense poem that manages to tell a big story in just over 100 lines. No, I'm not going to read 100 lines. This is just a sampler, huh? The Lady of Shalott is exciting, sad, a little sexy, a plain old beautiful at the same time. We know that's a big sell for a little poem, but it's backed by a whole bunch of fans going back more than 150 years. People have fallen in love with this poem over and over again, and it's inspired tons of songs and videos and paintings. We're pretty sure that once you dive into it, you'll see what all the fuss is about. This is the kind of poem that pulls you in fast and then sweeps you away. You like. On either side of the river lie long fields of barley and of rye that clothe the world and meet the sky. And through the field the road runs by to many-towered Camelot. And up and down the people go, gazing where the lilies blow, round an island there below, the island of Shalott. Willows whiten, aspens quiver, little breezes dusk and shiver. Though the wave that runs forever by the island in the river, flowing down to Camelot. Four gray walls and four gray towers overlook a space of flowers and silence isle embowers the Lady of Shalott. There she weaves by night and day a magic web that colors gay, and has heard a whisper say, a curse is on her if we stay. To look down to Camelot, she knows not what the curse may be, and little other care hath she, the Lady of Shalott. And moving through a mirror clear that hangs before her all the year, shadows of the world appear. There she sees the highway near, winding down to Camelot. There the river eddy whirls, and there the surly village churls, and the red cloaks of market girls pass onward from Shalott. A bow shot from her bower eaves, he rode between the barley sheaves. The sun came dazzling through the leaves and flamed upon the brazen greaves of bold Sir Lancelot. A red cross knight forever kneeled to a lady in his shield that sparkled on the yellow field beside remote Shalott. All in the blue unclouded weather, thickly jeweled shone the saddle leather, the helmet and the helmet feather burned like one burning flame together. And he rode down to Camelot as though the purple light below the starry clusters bright, some bearded meteor trailing light moves over still Camelot. Who is this, and what is here, and in the lighted palace near, died the sound of royal cheer, and they crossed themselves for fear, all the knights of Camelot. But Lancelot mused a little space. He said, she has a lovely face. God in his mercy lend her grace. The Lady of Camelot. Interesting to think that not so long ago, entire stories about cultures and people were carrying along the imagination of whole groups of people. I know them as reading the work of Tolkien, a student. And then the world knows the imagination of J.K. Rowling. These people were writing after they had accumulated a tremendous amount of research. And if you're careful, you'll see references to Masonry in there. The ideas, the values. Oh, really, do yourself a favor and read about the Enlightenment. Yeah, read about the connections. And in your own mind, make those value statements. Yeah. We're going to continue today with some of the ideas that were written by 17, published about 1775 by a fellow of a Mason who was also a scholar, William Meeson, Meeson. His book was entitled An Introduction to Freemasonry. I think it's out of print. But he wrote about quite a bit about the working tools and symbolism. But today we're going to borrow some of his ideas, share some of his ideas about the square. And interesting, still, I see what you think. As is pointed out, most of the squares supplied for lodge used today tend to have arms of equal length. But it is, that's true. But it is quite clear from what Meeson writes that the square he was writing of, and presumably this was the accepted square in Masonry in his day, was one with arms not of equal length. Nor was there likely to be any latitude in the proportions of the two arms, for these were bound to be in the proportion of 3 to 4, so that the missing side to make up a right angled triangle would measure 5 units and conform to the 47th proposition of Euclid. Sidney T. Klein develops this point in papers published in Ars Quattro Coronatum in 1897, article referred to as the Great Symbol. And in 1810, Magister Methelius, Klein tends very much towards the occult in his approach to symbolism, but he was at pains to point out that symbols, signs, and secrets of our fraternity were based upon what I call the knowledge of the square. And it is a natural, therefore, to expect the arrangement of the lodge to be in accordance with the same principle. Now, our oldest manuscripts maintain that at the head of all the liberal sciences stands geometry, which is Masonry. And that emanation from the first Grand Lodge called Anderson's Constitutions, first edition in 1723, and then polished in 1738, gives evidence as to what was then looked upon as the most important part of that head of all the sciences, for it specially names Euclid, Book 1, Proposition 47. It is clear that for Klein, writing from a different point of view and based on research and theory, arrived at a conclusion which accords with Meeson's description. When it first became the practice for the jewel of a past master to be based on the 47th proposition of Euclid, that was around 1820. It is interesting to note that the type of square first used, and this continued into the 1830s, was what is known as the gallows type, as portrayed by Klein and described by Meissen, you know, one arm longer than the other. Later writers also refer to the square. J.T. Lawrence in The Perfect Ashlar cites most of the ritual uses mentioned above and also the many times in the course of ceremony that movement and attitude have reference to the square. He also states that from the operative point of view, the importance of the square is derived from the fact that it is one of the three regular figures whose angle is an exact submultiple of 360 degrees, the other two being the triangle and the hexagon. The exact form of the square we use also concerns Lawrence. He writes, "What, first of all, should be the exact form of the square? The term square is something of a misnomer, as the symbol in question is but the two adjacent sides of a square. Let that pass, however. In many foreign lodges, and especially in lodges working under the Grand Orient of France, we find one limb shorter than the other, thus making it into a carpenter's square, which it is not. Marking it off in divisions to represent inches is somewhat unnecessary, as it thereby becomes a measuring instrument, which it is not. The stonemason's square is intended only as a test of rectangularity. The engraving, sometimes found on the two limbs, does not much matter, but the two ends should not be trimmed off with ornamental finials. The symbolism is very ancient." I'm going to leave off there today because the next portion talks to us about a square that was found in the foundation of a bridge.
Yeah.
Oh, you'll know. You'll know that one. Thank you. For each of you in Sonic Effects to be the winter of our discontent. Shakespeare was right. That's from Richard III. There was a point where we can recognize that turning point, that right angle. The time here where there is either a richness of culture or a despair at change. I choose to enjoy the celebration of the marketplace and the enthusiasm of people. I don't call it commercialism, but people are making profit from it, as it always happens. Caveat emptor, yeah. No, nothing startling there. I'm a grown man. We're all adults. And good times, they flow, but differently than when I was a boy. Good drink, good food, good music, good companionship. And we celebrate all of that. And it's also, as we come in, we're looking at the end of a year, whatever that is. Whatever that's measuring, it's measuring the turn of the seasons. And the days are getting shorter. And even the most concrete of us can recognize that it feels as if there's something ending, and it is. And then what happens in solstice? There's a moment when the day becomes longer, when we have more light, that growth, raw. And we aspire, and the world around us is leaning in, anticipating the warmth that will come. The nurturance, what we need in order to survive, us. So no need for the poets and painters to apologize for being motivated by this. No. Not at all. Then maybe the Druids did have a point. Maybe. And maybe there are metaphors found and collected in the major religions today that had their roots in the darkness of time. And don't think occult and pre-occult. That was a construct of the Christian faith. You know, when you're trying to make gain traction, you want to make as many points with as many people as you possibly can. So my faith borrowed like a bad thing. Borrowed some great ideas, dates and celebrations, and made them their own. Yeah. It wasn't just the Romans that could celebrate winter and holly and evergreen. No, we can use that too. And the dates, well, it happens to align with, you know, whatever your scripture is. It's kind of, I didn't feel threatened when I discovered that maybe the language that was used wasn't English. Maybe we were talking about different cultures and different races. Maybe. And maybe the metaphor is more profound than the literal translation. Well, it is for me. It's like masonry. You can take it literally or you can be a fundamentalist, although I wouldn't have any idea what the hell that would be. It's talking about the essentials of you and I. So embrace and enjoy as much as you can. At all, I'm selfish. I'm listening to wonderful music, but in my selfish side, I'm about to sit back and enjoy a football match here in Canada. It's an annual. It's a rite, and we'll enjoy. We're all going to be football fans for one day. Oh, ball up your little fists! No, become part of it. It's pretty cool. It's like becoming part of the compromise that's Freemasonry. Oh, seeing the same people day in and year by year, day in and day out, it forces us into a different truth, a different honesty about one another. And of course, we become domestic. It's not just the glory days of when we're first attracted. That's just heady times. No, this is like real life. Oh. In exchange, you seeing the irritable aspects of what goes on around you, everyone else is sharing yours. Oh, sorry. Thanks for tuning in today. I hope we've been productive. I hope we've added to the conversation for you. And commit those acts of random Masonic kindness, and I'll see you soon.